Hackers? Ransomware? Trolls? Are you afraid to be online?
How can we safeguard our information, financials, and peace of mind? By listening to What the Hack with Adam Levin.
A show about hackers, scammers, identity thieves, and the people they go after.
Recently named the best technology podcast by the Signal Awards.
Each week, we take a look at scams, cons, and phishing schemes and ask the question, what the heck?
And it's hosted by us, cybersecurity experts Adam, Bo, and Travis.
Plus, you'll get to hear from heavy-hitting guests like Daily Show correspondent Roy Wood Jr., Darknet Diaries host Jack Rhys-Ider, and former Senator Al Franken.
Listen to What the Hack with Adam Levin wherever you get your podcasts.
The Kremlin says drones from Ukraine were sent to assassinate Russian President Vladimir Putin. Kyiv denies responsibility.
We do know very little about what happened so far other than what the Kremlin told us, so I think a degree of skepticism is healthy here.
Also today, pollution in Thailand. On some days, it is the worst in the world.
And the sky is like this really streaky orangey red. I mean, it just looks scary.
That smog, it's driven by what you and I on the planet eat. And sidewalk surfing in Lahore, Pakistan, a new skate park has been built with help from international NGOs. Skateboarders there finally have a chance to see what it's all about.
The thing I love about this community is that it's really diverse. It's very inclusive, and it doesn't really exclude anybody.
I'm Marco Werman. Plus, a Hollywood writer's strike could bring more foreign films into your living room. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Good to have you here this Wednesday. Russia's war on Ukraine has taken a number of surprising turns, but what happened in Moscow in the early hours before dawn this morning is something we have not seen yet. Videos show two explosions over the Kremlin. A statement from the Kremlin says two drones tried to strike Russian President Vladimir Putin's Kremlin residence overnight. Moscow claims the drones were Ukrainian. Ukraine denies responsibility. The Kremlin is calling the event a terrorist attack and an attempt to assassinate Putin. But like much of the news coming out of Russia, it's hard to sort out facts from propaganda. Max Sedin, the Financial Times Moscow bureau chief, is following the story closely from Latvia's capital, Riga.
The Kremlin said that Putin wasn't there. He doesn't actually live in the Kremlin. He sometimes spends nights there, but he lives mostly at the residence outside Moscow. And nobody was harmed. That is the Kremlin's version of events. Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, denied this, said that Ukraine was not behind it. They're suggesting Kyiv that this may have been some sort of false flag attack to justify whatever new plans Russia may have to attack Ukraine. We do know very little about what happened so far other than what the Kremlin told us. So I think a degree of skepticism is healthy here.
Has Ukraine said anything else about the incident?
Ukraine has suggested that Russia, you know, some sort of Gulf of Tonkin thing, that Russia, you know, staged it so that they could frame Ukraine. But you know, Ukraine certainly has good drone capabilities. Some people in the Ukrainian military have been talking about using long-range drones. And as they've proved by, you know, defying most people's expectations that they would get crushed by Russia in this war, Ukraine has proved itself a very effective fighting force. So it's not going to be that easy to piece this one together.
Yeah, so that false flag operation idea, kind of Gulf of Tonkin, is that plausible? And to what end would the Kremlin stage that?
I don't want to speculate too much here, but one thing that's very, you know, important to stress is that this is a pretty embarrassing moment for the Kremlin. You know, they went from beginning of the war, you know, thinking they were going to take Kyiv in a matter of days, and it's more than a year now, and so they're saying the president was unharmed in the attempt on his life that we were not able to adequately prevent. Because if you accept that Ukraine did it, it meant that a Ukrainian drone flew something like 800 kilometers behind the front lines, wasn't picked up at any point by Russian anti-air defenses, and was able to attempt this strike on the Kremlin. Or it means there are some sort of Ukrainian underground group. And we do know from some other attacks that Ukraine has successfully carried out behind enemy lines, such as the attack on the Crimean Bridge in October, that Ukraine does have a capacity to do things like this. Just this week, we've seen drone strikes in southern Russia on regions bordering Ukraine that have army supply routes. We've seen two railroads have been sabotaged just in the last couple of days. One Russian expert I spoke to said it was possible that a Ukrainian group could have launched a drone from somewhere near Moscow that would have been a commercial drone retrofitted with weapons, which would have been much more difficult for Russian anti-air defense to pick up. It would be flying a much shorter distance to the Kremlin. But the fact that this is, however you spin it, it's a pretty significant embarrassment.
It also raises the question, I mean, the Kremlin is heavily guarded. How could drones penetrate that sort of security and airspace?
Well, we've seen through the many failures of the Russian army during this war that there are a lot of people who aren't very good at doing their job. And that wouldn't be the first time this has happened. In the late 1980s, this is one of the major symbols of the decline of the Soviet Union. There was a German teenager, Matthias Rust, who flew a small biplane all the way from Germany to Moscow and landed in Red Square. And he went completely undetected because it was border guards day and they were all drunk. So this wouldn't be the first major screw up by Russia's military and secret services during this war. It would only be the latest of many. That said, with false flag attacks, we also do know that Russia is basically run by the security services. Putin himself is veteran and former head of the security services in Russia. He doesn't call the war. He calls it a special operation, and it was planned in secret, unbeknownst to even most of his closest aides, which is really reeks of someone who's OD'd on their KGB spy tradecraft.
Max, you saw this Kremlin statement earlier today that Russia reserves the right to take retaliatory measures when and where it sees fit. What do you make of that?
I think the issue is that if they're going to retaliate, what are they going to do? They already tried to kill Zelensky at the beginning of the war. They have razed Ukrainian cities to the face of the earth.
Max Sedin is the Financial Times Moscow bureau chief. He joined us from Riga, Latvia's capital, to talk about the two apparent drone strikes on the Kremlin early this morning. Max, thanks very much.
Thank you. Take care.
France has been rocked by months of protests against President Emmanuel Macron's decision to raise a retirement age. Macron forced the change through Parliament and hopes it will be implemented by the fall, but the battle is far from over. On Monday, May Day, International Workers' Day, hundreds of thousands of people took to the French streets in major demonstrations, and now workers in the energy sector are threatening massive power cuts unless the French president reverses course. From Paris, Theo Mertz has a story.
France's largest energy union declared today a national day of anger. Not that the weeks leading up to it have exactly been calm. As well as continued protests like today's, power cuts could disrupt major events planned for coming months, including the Cannes Film Festival, the French Open Tennis Tournament, and the Monaco Formula One Grand Prix. In a business district of Paris, members of the CGT Energy Union have gathered for a demonstration. Frédéric Prebel is a representative of the group.
Pour que les gens y mesurent vraiment en quoi consiste notre métier, c'est effectivement d'éteindre la lumière. Comme ça, ils se rendent compte que.
He defends the threat of power cuts, saying that politicians must be made to understand the energy sector's value. If we don't work, there's no light, he says, and we can't carry on working until we're in our mid-60s. That's the message we're trying to convey as calmly but forcefully as possible. Millions of people from all walks of life have taken part in more than a dozen national protest days since the pension reform plans were announced. Transport workers have gone on strike and rubbish collectors have let trash pile up in the streets. But energy workers, like Prebel, say they will be particularly hard hit.
Ce régime spécial, il a par rapport au régime général, il nous permet de partir. Pour ceux qui interviennent sur le réseau.
He explains the reforms will remove a special dispensation that allows those working certain jobs in the sector to retire 5 years early. When they do retire under the new system, their payments will be less, he says, and this means that fewer young people will be willing to join the industry. Power cuts are a relatively common protest tactic in France. Last month, workers cut electricity at an airport and school that Macron was visiting in the south of the country. The president's official residence has also been targeted, along with the offices of politicians who support the reforms. At the same time, unions say they're providing free power to some schools, hospitals and other buildings in what they call Robin Hood actions as energy prices rise. Guillaume is a member of an energy union at the demonstration who declined to give his last name because of concerns about his work. He's enthusiastic about these guerrilla protests.
Ah, mais c'est une bonne chose. Ça leur rappelle qu'il y a des gens aussi qui vivent.
It's good to cut politicians' electricity, he says. It's so that they can understand what life is like for people in poverty and those in precarious situations. Members of Macron's government have branded such protests illegal. Prime Minister Elisabeth Borne has urged the national grid to file criminal complaints against anyone found carrying them out. Camille Mabi is an employment law specialist based in the west of France.
Oui, ça va arriver parce qu'en fait, à chaque fois, ils le font. C'est un jeu de pression, en fait.
She says the grid is likely to file these complaints, but prosecutions will be hard to carry out because of the protected nature of strikes in France.
Bah, je pense que, au regard de l'exemple de ce qui s'est passé dans le secteur des transports.
Mabie suggests that if the tactic continues, the government might tighten the law to prevent it being used. Some cases have already been brought against those behind power cuts. Those at the protest today say they are well aware of the legal risks, but will do whatever it takes to force Macron's hand and score a victory for the common good. The president has called for a period of reconciliation after the unrest of the past few months. But with power cuts planned and more nationwide protests already scheduled, this seems unlikely. For The World, I'm Theo Mertz in Paris.
It's been 70 years since the first person got to the top of Mount Everest, at least according to official records. This year, as climbing season begins, more people than ever are trying to reach the summit. Nepal's tourism department has issued more than 460 permits, a 40% increase from last year. The World's Bianca Hillier reports that's been drawing a range of reactions.
There are a number of reasons why so many people are trying to summit the world's highest peak in Nepal. Some say this season's record high is a post-pandemic surge, while others point to new, stricter climbing rules on the Chinese side of Everest, which have inadvertently sent more people to Nepal's side. And like everything else, social media is driving interest, with more people posting their summit selfies.
They just want to go to the top of the world, right?
Rojita Adhikari is a journalist in Kathmandu. She spoke with some Everest climbers just before the season started. They told her they were looking for that once-in-a-lifetime experience only Everest can provide.
If you have all resources, right, if I have money, time, and a passion for climbing, why not go to Everest?
Summiting the Himalayan mountain is an athletic and skill-based accomplishment. Nepal's government is all for it. Adhikari points out that Everest is a multi-million dollar business.
And Nepal government is charging like $11,000 per foreign climber. It means they have collected around $5 million revenue. From Everest alone, not from other mountains. There are other mountains also.
Mountaineering is a cornerstone of the economy in Nepal, where many people rely on international climbers to make a living, including Sherpas. They're members of a Tibetan ethnic group renowned for their mountaineering skills.
Sherpas are very happy because they are getting a business.
Adhikari is quick to point out Sherpas are hugely underpaid, but they're essential to a successful summit. Many companies leading trips up Everest offer one Sherpa per climber plus other guides. So this climbing season, more than 1,000 people will be trying to reach the top. Half climbers, half support staff. Gordon Jano is with U.S.-based Alpine Ascents, a company that leads people up Everest. He's long been worried about overcrowding and traffic jams near the peak.
It's been like this for a number of years, so it's not new. And, you know, we should be limiting permits, but there's no mechanism to do that. That's what the issue is.
Nepal's tourism department, which issues the permits, did not reply to my request for comment. Jano says his company has 4 paying climbers on the mountain now, but that doesn't include his staff.
Maybe Summit Day will have 9 or 10 or 8, you know, depending on how it works out.
As hundreds of people scale the mountain over the next few weeks, doctors are warning about what could go wrong.
Yeah, there are a lot of concerns.
Dr. Hermann Brueger is with the Institute of Mountain Emergency Medicine. Mount Everest tops out at 29,000 feet. Dr. Brueger worries about bad weather hitting while hundreds of people queue near the peak, then have to navigate a traffic jam on the way down.
It's very difficult to survive if they do not descend immediately. The risk is, of course, that they die from hypoxia, lack of oxygen from bottled oxygen, frostbite, of course, and hypothermia.
Dr. Brueger says high-altitude rescues also become more dangerous, as one rescue mission would stall crowds of people at extreme heights for longer. Jano says his climbers and guides work to combat the risks by keeping an agile and relatively small team.
For us, boy, this is the day that everybody's going up the mountain. We're going to go tomorrow. We're going to go the next day.
They hope to reach the summit by the end of May. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. This next story from the Arab Gulf might sound like deja vu all over again, to borrow a phrase from Yogi Berra. Drone video released today by the U.S. Navy shows a supertanker being swarmed by speedboats. The footage is pretty dramatic. A Panama flag tanker, the length of three football fields, is sailing along on calm seas, then more than a dozen tiny speedboats overtake it. The seizure of the Niobe is the second such capture by Tehran in recent days. Rockford Weitz is director of maritime studies at Tufts University's Fletcher School. Professor Weitz, what exactly happened to the Niobe?
Well, the Iranian Navy swarmed the vessel with a number of fast attack small boats and brought it into their harbor on the northern side of the Strait of Hormuz, which connects the Arabian Gulf or Persian Gulf with the Arabian Sea, and is holding it there. And this has been happening fairly consistently since 2019.
Why this ship and why now?
It's always a little unclear exactly what's motivating the Iranian government and the Iranian Navy. It's likely related to the continued negotiations over the Iran nuclear deal. It could also be related in a sort of tit for tat that's taking place between the United States and its allies and partners and Iran over Iranian crude oil exports. And these are being seized by the United States and our allies and partners, either physically or financially, where the U.S. government will use financial sanctions to effectively seize the Iranian crude oil before it reaches its destination.
Yeah, so the tanker flies a Panamanian flag, but you're saying Iran is really targeting the U.S. and its partners with these captures.
That's correct. So the international shipping is very global. And the Panamanian flag has a storied history as a open registry, or some would call a flag of convenience. Bottom line, the Panamanian flag, that's more of a signal of the international nature of global shipping. This isn't really a symbol of Iran-Panamanian tensions, if you will.
Right. Now, another vessel, the Advantage Suite, was captured in the same way 2 weeks ago and is docked now at an Iranian port. Is this part of a trend? And is Iran playing by international maritime rules?
They would say they are. Many other commentators would say they're not. And I would side on the majority of commentators who look at the law of the sea and other international maritime law would say that this would be an abuse of international maritime law. But as we say at the Fletcher School, when it comes to international law, the question is who enforces it and who decides. So it's not like there's a global police force that is there to enforce the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea. Instead, it is the interpretation of the states. They can go to arbitration, but that requires mutual consent and has not happened in any of these tanker seizures.
So, Rockford, what do you think is going to happen to both the Advantage Suite and this latest vessel capture, the Niobe?
I suspect that they will be held in Iranian waters for days, weeks, months, depending on what is happening behind the scenes. It's not surprising that this is happening at the same time as renewed tensions between Russia and Ukraine and China and Taiwan, all of which is driving some instability in crude oil markets. Crude oil is a global commodity. So when there's some instability in one part of the world, then a player like Iran, which has the small boats around the Strait of Hormuz that can quickly go in and seize tankers, can show that we have a geography advantage to disrupt oil markets, which will influence oil prices in the United States, Japan, EU countries, and we don't want policymakers to forget that.
Rockford Weitz is director of maritime studies at Tufts University's Fletcher School, giving us background on the capture of a supertanker off the coast of Iran. Rockford, thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You can find people skateboarding pretty much all over the globe, but in Pakistan, it hasn't really taken off. Gear is hard to come by, even in major cities, and roads, especially in older parts of town, well, let's just say it's not the smoothest ride. But Pakistan's first international standard skate park is giving more people a chance to see what skateboarding is really all about. Betsy Joles has more from the city of Lahore.
For 10-year-old Kumal, Haider, an evening at the skate park starts with a game of rock, paper, scissors. Haider, his brother Mustafa, and a group of young boys take turns riding a shared skateboard. He will take a turn, then he will, then him, and then me, Haider says. He and his friends have just gotten into skateboarding since this park opened down the street from where they live. The skate park came about thanks in part to Shehan Hassan, the founder of Skate Pakistan. It's an organization that supports skateboarders through mentorships and community. Hassan was born in Peshawar and spent his childhood in Abu Dhabi, where he picked up skateboarding. When he moved back to Pakistan, he wanted to introduce more people to the sport.
The experiences that I had and the love of the community that I felt growing up, I wanted that to be available to the younger generation in Pakistan.
He sees skating as a way to bring people from different social classes together.
There are some unsaid social, socioeconomic boundaries that we find in our society. Forming a lasting bond or a relationship, that's something that socioeconomic boundaries create challenges in.
Hassan got a chance to bridge those boundaries with support from Salad Days of Skateboarding, a U.S.-based nonprofit started by professional skateboarder Nestor Judkins. After seeing a video of skateboarders in Pakistan, Judkins proposed the idea for a skate park there.
Main motivation is to allow the boards to be used by people who would never get to use them. And so really, that's where the benefit lies.
With help from another organization called Wonders Around the World, the skate park opened in March in Lawrence Gardens, now known as Bagijina, which dates back to the 1860s. Most people welcomed the skate park, but a few opposed it because of its placement in a historically significant site. Hassan and the team wanted it to be in a central location where people from different backgrounds could gather. On a Friday at dusk, the park is full of skaters and surrounded by curious onlookers. Abdul Khan has already become a regular here. He even sweeps the ramps himself before others arrive. Every day, he rides his skateboard across town to get to his restaurant job near the park. He sometimes gets questions about skateboarding from people along the way. Khan explains how he shares his contact number with people so he can tell them more about the sport. The skate community has become really important to Khan since his parents passed away. I'm very happy when I play the game here, he says. 19-year-old Fatima Sef found out about the park through friends and is one of a few girls here.
The thing I love about this community is that it's really diverse. It's very inclusive and it doesn't really exclude anybody.
Sef borrows a board for now but hopes to get her own soon. 14-year-old Amar Fawad is also new to the sport.
I barely know about skateboarding. I don't know how do I get the decks, skateboard and all those things.
Now he's hooked.
Got to leave for skateboarding.
As the sun sets over the park, skaters stay on, talking and riding under the lights. For The World, I'm Betsy Joles in Lahore, Pakistan.
You're listening to The World. In the age of climate change, animals are adapting too, like South African squirrels. The size of their feet now compared to less than 20 years ago, that shocked wildlife biologists.
I'm like, oh my God! Because you can see it, right?
How a changing climate alters how animals behave, live, even what they look like. Ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. These days, there is no shortage of international TV shows and movies on streaming platforms like Netflix.
40년 전 한반도는 사막으로 변했다. 생존자는 단 1%.
Hard to make sense of that without subtitles, but that's a scene from a new Korean dystopian series called The Black Knight. With the start of the writer's strike in Hollywood this week, studios just may look to fill more gaps with international hits. Miranda Banks is here to answer that for us. She's an associate professor at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, focusing on film, television, and media studies. So while American writers are striking, will American streaming platforms and broadcasters look to foreign productions to fill the gap?
Absolutely. And once upon a time, it used to be that a lot of the gap was filled by reality TV, and that will be a huge piece of the puzzle. But international programs will become important, in particular for the streamers. So less so for broadcast television, you're going to probably see the reality TV there. But in terms of streamers, there's going to be a good number of pickups and a number of audiences really looking for those international shows that will be new products in the line. That said, there's a lot of things still in production. So depending on how long this strike goes on for, we may still be seeing some American shows still coming out for a while before those all wash up.
Do you think studios have been preparing for the potential of a strike for a while and already lined up some international shows, or at least intensely combing through the offerings?
Absolutely. So everybody has been talking in the industry about the potential for this to become a strike. And so there has been a lot of purchasing of series. And so internationally and nationally, a lot of shows have been picked up and kind of in the pipeline as we speak.
There have been a lot of hits from abroad already. There's Squid Game from South Korea, Lupin from France, Casa de Papel from Spain, just to name a few. Is this a big opportunity for foreign filmmakers?
It's a good opportunity, but again, we need to realize that it's got to be a really great product for it to blow up in the way that some of those shows that you mentioned said. So we definitely will see a number of programs become the great hit of the moment, and I'm excited to see what those are. But at the same time, we really want to kind of trying to balance that out, that this might, it really depends on how long the strike will go on.
Well, I mentioned Squid Game and Lupin. They're both on Netflix and produced by Netflix. How does that work when writers in LA are walking off Netflix productions?
What we've had in the last few days really is a number of international writers' guilds making notes and stating online or on their Twitter presence, expressing their solidarity to the Writers Guild of America, but they aren't under contract with the Writers Guild. And so it's a very different system. They can express solidarity, but at the same time, if you're not working for a US company and you're working for a Canadian corporation, then the rules are different.
Yeah. Do entertainment writers in other countries have the same compensation concerns as US writers, like the writers on strike right now?
So the compensation issues are different country to country, and that is for a lot of different reasons. But at the most basic level, we're dealing with different ways of making film and television. So country by country, we might have different systems and different agreements that are made. But for many of those writers who are interested in making a name for themselves, some of them will always want to look to the US market and how things are done as the standard bearers. So what's going to happen in this negotiation might down the road lead to shifts or changes in how television is made in other countries, but more important, how television is compensated.
So back to the current labor action, Miranda, does the availability and interest in internationally produced shows, does that dilute the bargaining leverage that the writers' union has?
I don't think so. I think that it's definitely a challenge and something that people are aware of. But we need to also think about how much US television is made in other countries as well. So the impact might be great for other countries in terms of potentially getting some series out there, and there might be some added buzz or added attention looking for that hot new international series. But at the same time, the national and global impact of this Writers Guild strike, if it continues, won't just be felt within Los Angeles, but will be felt in Georgia, Louisiana, New York, and New Mexico, and ultimately in productions that are based in Toronto, Vancouver, Croatia, etc.
Miranda Banks is an associate professor at Loyola Marymount University, focused on film, television, and media studies, giving us the basics on screenwriter concerns here and around the globe as the WGA strike continues. She joined us from Los Angeles. Miranda, thank you so much.
Thank you, Marco.
Thailand, sadly, is breaking records for toxic air. Some cities on bad days are recording the worst pollution in the world. The thick smog there leads to nosebleeds, sore throats, even fatal diseases. Despite the public outcry, the government has not been able to get things under control. The World's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok looked into the root causes of this crisis and found that a lot of it right now is connected to the food you and I eat.
In certain parts of Thailand, on a terrible air day, just breathing is like smoking 15 cigarettes. Dr. Rangsit Kanchanawanit has seen the effects in hospital wards. He's a cardiologist at Chiang Mai University in northern Thailand.
You wouldn't see hospital filled up with dead people because it doesn't happen like that. If you smoke today, you smoke like a pack of cigarettes. You wouldn't die right away.
But you might die slowly, he says, of heart disease, strokes, or lung cancer, which is abnormally high in Thailand's most polluted areas. In recent years, toxic air has become a fact of life in Thailand. At bus stops and cafes, people chat about pollution like the weather. Everyone knows the scientific terms like particulate matter 2.5, the deadliest particles in the air.
Very small particles enter bloodstream. They cause inflammation to blood vessels all around the body, stiffness of the arteries, and cause blood to thicken, easily clot.
The World Health Organization says these particles contribute to more than 30,000 Thai people dying each year. On really hazy days, the air actually looks toxic.
And the sky is like this really streaky orangey red. I mean, it just looks scary.
Weena Lolita Nonda is a co-founder of the Thai Clean Air Network, a watchdog group.
It almost looks like a version of Armageddon, like something out of a really bad movie, right?
I asked Weena about the source of the haze, and she showed me satellite photos of Thailand, taken by NASA. The maps are overlaid with little red dots showing heat signatures. Each red spot is a fire.
Each red spot is a fire.
In recent months, the red dots have consumed the map.
When you get to April, shabam, it's literally everywhere. So you see red spots, you know, sort of scattered throughout.
The thing is, almost all of these fires are set on purpose by poor farmers with an important job. They literally feed the world. Thailand is an agricultural powerhouse. If you eat rice or sugar, chances are you've consumed crops grown here. And if you eat chicken, someone maybe fattened it up on corn grown in Thailand. But each year, Thai farmers generate heaps of crop waste, rice stalks, sugarcane stalks, corn husks, and they have to somehow get rid of it.
And when the farmers don't have a solution, they go for the cheaper solution. And unfortunately, it's a matchstick.
They set it all on fire. People will post videos on social media filmed at those red dots, like this one, of the countryside in flames. The guy filming says, I pity every human being hit by all this smoke. But Weena says, pity the farmers too. To properly dispose of that waste, they would need a combine harvester, a machine that's $200,000 used. That's like 50 years' salary for these farmers. And yet the media and officials often blame farmers for the fires.
They're represented in the media as uneducated people who are stubborn, so they don't understand that breathing in these toxic air is bad for them.
Weena's mission is to divert attention to the corporations, the big ag companies that hire these farmers at pitiful rates to produce crops they export for big profits. Each year, these companies make billions. Also complicit, Weena says, are people in richer countries. Someone in Tokyo or Chicago can buy a sugary soda for cheap because the sugar or corn that sweetened that soda comes from Thailand.
You are actually creating the demand for a lot of these products at the end of the day. So you are part of the whole entire chain. I mean, the responsibility has to be from farm to fork.
Thailand's larger ag corporations say they are putting traceability systems in place to ensure they're not buying from farmers who burn waste. But Weena says the government isn't forcing them to stay accountable.
There's a lot of optics, so a lot of looking like they're doing something. For example, in Bangkok, there's a lot of spraying of water around.
Spraying water. Officials will shoot water cannons into the air or fly drones that sprinkle water around. They say it cleans the air. Rangsit Kanchanawanit, the doctor, has personally told officials, wake up. This is an emergency.
The root cause of the problem, the burning, these things need political will to change. It's not easy, but I don't see political will at all. It's just talk, talk, talk.
Many people pin their hopes on a draft law, now in parliament, that would heavily tax agriculture companies for their role in the fires.
The writing's on the wall. Companies, you are a corporate citizen and you need to be responsible for your entire supply chain.
For now, all the people of Thailand can do is pray for monsoons to wash the pollution away. For The World, Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
In China, a lot more people could soon be accused of being a spy. That's because Chinese lawmakers recently expanded the nation's counter-espionage laws. foreign business people, journalists, and academics are now worried that they'll be snared in the wider net. Robert Daly is the director of the Kissinger Institute on China and U.S. relations at the Wilson Center. He joins us from Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan. What are the specifics of this new amendment, Robert?
Well, one of the problems with the new counterespionage law is that it's very short on specifics. It is based on a very expansive view of what constitutes national security in China. Any information that is broadly related to China's interests that is collected by any foreigner. So it's deliberately vague, and it also, in essence, deputizes all Chinese if they see any foreigner or any Chinese doing something, trying to get some kind of information that they think might be detrimental to the nation, then they can turn people in.
So in this community of foreign business people, journalists, academics, et cetera, in China, have you personally been hearing concern? And specifically, what is it about?
The immediate concern that's new comes from the business community. And this is not only because of the new counterespionage law. It's also because China has been raiding long-established American businesses in China recently and has not been providing very much information, either about why they've done it or, in some cases, why they've taken people away. They went into the due diligence firm Mintz, for example, and five local Chinese who work for Mintz have been taken away. What a due diligence firm is anytime there's a company that wants to do business in China, there's an awful lot of information that they have to know that their business model is sustainable, which is not in the public sphere in China. Are their Chinese partners reliable? For example, what are the backgrounds of the companies and the Chinese executives that they might be working with? More recently, there are other concerns that have been posed by the American Congress, like, are there supply chains in some way tied to forced labor in Xinjiang, where a lot of Uyghurs have been compelled to do forced labor by China? And so you need a due diligence company to try to find out the things that aren't in the public sphere. So clearly that function is both essential for business, but it's inherently threatening to China. And they've already raided one such company. They've also raided Mitt Romney's old company, Bain, which is a consulting company in Beijing, with no explanation.
Wow. As for journalists and academics, would the fear also be credible? And what would they be worried about?
If you're going for information that the Communist Party hasn't supplied to you in Xi Jinping's China, there's a good chance that you're prying something that can be construed as a national secret. Mm. An always very secretive government has become more paranoid. And so, yes, this could have an impact on normal academic activity, the work of think tankers, the work of what few NGOs remain in China, as well as business people and journalists.
So back to business people, foreign business people in China. I mean, the U.S. and Chinese economies are deeply intertwined. Is it possible that American business people might just say, you know what, even if it's a small risk, it's not worth it. I'm taking my business elsewhere. And if that happens, what would that mean for business ties between the U.S. and China?
Well, this is already occurring to some degree. China is now holding about eight times the number of people it was several years ago under exit bans, meaning that people are not under arrest, but they are not allowed to leave China until various kinds of civil suits have been cleared up. The Japanese in particular have had some of their business people arrested in China and accused directly of espionage. Mm. Now, if you listen to the warnings from the American Chamber of Commerce, for example, and other experts, they're saying that you need to be more careful.
I mean, China is already, we know, a surveillance state. You said this new expansion of counter-espionage laws there allows China a more expansive view of national security. So if you had to characterize this new law, would you say it's about paranoia on the part of Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party, or simply the next logical step in any surveillance state?
I think it's a logical step in any surveillance state, and that Xi Jinping's sense of being under threat by the United States, while I think it was always part of his makeup and it has elements of paranoia in it, that has also been exacerbated by specific actions of the United States. The Trump administration's launching in 2018 of a trade war, of increasing of tariffs that are still on under the Biden administration. Spring of 2016, then Secretary of State Michael Pompeo, in a speech at the Nixon Library, calling for the Chinese people to essentially rise up and to change their government. So we do aim to contain the growth of China's power. And the United States has drawn closer to Taiwan and provided more support for it in a way that China sees as backing off of the United States' pledge to honor the One China Agreement. Now, I'm not defending the Chinese position in every case, but given where they sit and what they believe, it's not unreasonable for them to feel an attack by the United States.
Robert Daly is the director of the Kissinger Institute on China and U.S. Relations at the Wilson Center, speaking with us from Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan. Robert, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
If climate change is bad for humans, it's also not good for the entire animal kingdom. It increases the risk of extinction for more than 10,000 species already under threat. But as temperatures heat up, some animals are better poised to adapt. That's the focus today of our Climate Solutions segment, The Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Science reporter Ari Daniel has a look at how a few animals are adapting to climate change and the limits of that adaptation.
Mia Warrington first laid eyes on Cape ground squirrels in 2021 when she went to the dry grasslands of South Africa and watched them darting about.
You see the heat and you see all the human activity. So immediately I start thinking about how these animals might be adapting to climate change.
Adapting by altering the size of parts of their bodies. So Warrington, a conservation biologist at the University of Manitoba, set out to measure the squirrels. But first, she had to catch them.
They love peanut butter, just like manna from heaven for them. We put it out in these traps, and they go, ooh, peanut butter. And they get in, and then we take them up the traps, and we do the measurements.
One of those measurements was foot length.
Yeah, they have their little foot, and you take calipers, and you just put them on from the toe to the heel. You just go, this seems freakishly large, you know? It just felt that way for me.
Warrington's colleagues have been measuring the foot length of these squirrels for almost two decades, so she was able to look back through time, compare it to today's squirrels, and test her hunch.
I'm like, oh my God! So... because you could see it, right?
The average foot length compared to their body length had increased by 9% in just 18 years. The reason? Warrington says it might be because it's getting hotter.
So when their bodies get hot, it kind of the heat radiates out of big feet. So it's one way of dissipating heat.
She's got to do more work to nail down the cause and effect, in part because other changes in squirrel dimensions didn't seem to correspond to hotter temperatures. But Warrington's work is part of a growing body of evidence that, especially in animals where generations reproduce fairly quickly, climate change can cause them to shapeshift.
Oh, we got shrews. And then so many birds.
For instance, in Finland, as winters have grown milder, the number of brown tawny owls has surged compared to gray ones. That's because the brown owls are better at blending in with a less and less snowy environment. But adaptation doesn't always lead to visible changes. Sometimes the changes happen inside an animal's body, like the montane horned lizard.
You know those lizards that shoot blood out of their eye? That's them. We call them angry pancakes because they're flat and spiky.
Yale University evolutionary biologist Martha Munoz has studied these lizards in Mexico.
Their ability to perform a task such as sprinting or digestion is optimized over a relatively narrow range of temperatures and then decreases at higher and lower temperatures until the animal is immobilized.
Too cold and the lizards get sluggish, but too hot and they start to cook. Now, their environment had gotten slightly warmer, and Munoz was curious if the lizards had adapted. So she gathered up several dozen of them, and then...
we systematically cooler heat the lizards by 1 degree per minute, flip them onto their backs, and then determine the temperature at which they lose the ability to flip themselves back over, this being the thermal limit to locomotion.
Munoz and her colleagues found that the lizards had upped their heat tolerance by about a degree.
They're less comfortable in the cold and more comfortable in the heat.
Did that change happen over several years or?
1 year.
1 year? Wow.
Yep.
Some of this change was temporarily induced by the environment. Think of it as a kind of environmental plasticity. But some of the change was genetic, meaning the lizards evolved a higher heat tolerance and were passing it from one generation to the next. Munoz says this is to be expected of species with large population sizes, since this often produces
a lot of genetic variation, and genetic variation is the raw material for evolution.
This combination of genetic evolution and more temporary environmental plasticity is helping other species survive warmer temperatures as well, like the Acropora coral in American Samoa. Now, so far we've considered how animals' bodies have shifted in response to a changing climate, but some animals are adapting behaviorally. Pink-footed geese in the Arctic, for example. They've developed a new migration route and breeding ground as warming temperatures have opened up new habitat. Thomas Lamaris is an ecologist at the Royal Netherlands Institute for Sea Research, and he says birds like the pink-footed geese benefit from being social.
The way they behave is they learn often from their parents or from other geese,
which allows an adaptive change in behavior to propagate quickly through a population. Lamaris has seen the same thing firsthand at a spot in the remote western Russian Arctic.
It used to be a fishing village. Consists of five houses.
Lamaris studies barnacle geese on the tundra there.
They are, I would say, very cute black and white geese. They love the crowds. They like to make themselves heard, and they're very noisy.
This is a recording of the geese on their wintering grounds in the Netherlands. These birds winter across Western Europe and fly north to the Arctic to breed. They stop along the way, fueling up on fresh, nutritious grass that's just emerged from the melting snow. Lamaris found that in years when the snow melts early, they don't make stops to feed along the way. Instead, they make this mad dash to the breeding grounds.
They would really speed up their migration, and they would be able to make the journey that would otherwise take 2 weeks. They could do the same thing in 4 days.
When they landed, they were just spent.
They would need a longer time to recover before they could lay their eggs.
In other words, there was a cost. But Lamaris is heartened by what he sees as an ability for a migratory species like the barnacle goose to adapt to a warming climate.
These animals to be quite flexible in how they time these journeys.
Still, adaptation, whether it's genetic or behavioral, can only get a species so far. As our climate continues to change, some animals are being pushed right up to their limits. Martha Munoz again.
Everything that organisms do is simply buying time. But if you're going up a mountain, there's only so far you can go. And if you're going polewards, there's only so far you can go. And when you're adapting your physiology, guess what? There's an upper limit to how far that can go too. And if we don't reverse action, they are truly running out of options because we're giving them no others.
So all these adaptations, says Munoz, they're telling us we need to slow climate change down, even halt it altogether. We need to act, she says, not the opposite. For The World, I'm Ari Daniel.
You can check out all of our climate solutions reporting at theworld.org/bigfix. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We hope to see you right back here tomorrow.